Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to Slice of Cheese with Jenny Linford on Food FM. Savour the crunch of Peter's Yard sourdough crackers. Available at Waitrose, Sainsbury's, Morrison's, Ocado, Amazon, petersyard.com and specialist food retailers.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.
Hello, welcome to A Slice of Cheese, the Food FM radio series that celebrates the world of cheese. I'm Jenny Linford, a food writer and cheese enthusiast, the author of Great British Cheeses. Cheese is a delicious and fascinating food, and we're setting out to explore this remarkable food and share the stories of the people who make, sell and love it. Tiny organisms known as microbes, which are too small to be seen without a microscope, play a key part in cheesemaking. We delve into the fascinating world of microbes with Bronwyn Percival, co-author of Reinventing the Wheel, and cheese affineur Josh Windsor of Murray's Cheese in New York City.
Online, on smart speakers and on Listen Again, this is Food FM.
Savour the crunch of Peter's Yard sourdough crackers. Available at Waitrose, Sainsbury's, Morrison's, Ocado, Amazon, petersyard.com and specialist food retailers.
This week on A Slice of Cheese, very happy to have with me today Bronwyn Percival, author of a fascinating book about cheese called Reinventing the Wheel, Milk, Microbes and the Fight for Real Cheese. Good morning, Bronwyn.
Morning, Jenny.
Now, Bronwyn, it's an old friend of the programme. It's lovely to have you on it again. And I happen to know that microbes are something you're absolutely fascinated by. And I think for a lot of people, they don't really realise quite how important microbes are to cheese. But I thought we'd start with in a very sort of basic way. Perhaps you could explain to us that term microbe, what does it mean?
So when we refer to microbes, we're really referring to the entire world of microscopic organisms, organisms that are really much too small to see with the naked eye, but which, as you mentioned, play a really fundamental role in cheese making, both in the initial stages where you're turning milk into curd, but also really crucially in the ripening stages when you're turning that curd into some ripened cheese with extraordinary flavors. Microbes are central to all of those processes.
So are bacteria, are microbes, I'm guessing then, is that right?
So yes, absolutely. Microbes in the cheesemaking sense really refer to three different things: bacteria, yeasts, and molds. And so the bacteria are important both in the cheesemaking, the initial stages, and in the ripening stage, depending on the style of cheese. And then yeasts and molds really come into their own during the later stages of maturation. Essentially, they're our partners in developing flavor.
Now, it's interesting because you've explained that, microbes were not seen with the naked eye. So presumably our knowledge of them is a sort of, in the history of cheesemaking, is our knowledge of microbes something that comes along in later stages then?
Indeed. And it's really extraordinary to think that cheese was made for hundreds, if not thousands of years before anybody actually knew that there were such things as microbes, what they were doing or the role that they were playing in cheesemaking. So you see cheesemaking understood as a process, but really even the idea of acidification being driven by lactic acid bacteria, which is the fundamental way in which, milk is preserved as cheese, really only beginning to be understood at the end of the 19th century. So really in the blink of an eye of history of cheese.
Isn't that amazing? And as I say, how impressive that all the cheesemakers, were making cheese successfully for so long, within a way, in sort of in a way working in the dark, one might say then, I suppose.
It's really interesting to sort of put yourself in the mind of a pre-modern cheesemaker and to see the process as they might have seen it, as one of adding rennet to milk and manipulating curds, but really not one of microbe farming, even though realistically microbe farming is exactly what they were doing. The process of cheesemaking really developed through trial and error over many centuries across many, many thousands of farms in different places in different ways. But unwittingly, each of those processes developed as a way of herding and farming microbes to make the cheeses that people learn to make.
That's a wonderful way of putting it. And there's a wonderful resonance then, of course, to the farming of animals that we can see, like cows and sheep, you know, which, again, essential to cheesemaking. And then, this whole sort of invisible world that, that wasn't known. And so perhaps we could unpick slightly. So within the world of microbes, and if we talk about bacteria, presumably they're good bacteria and bad bacteria from the cheesemaking point of view. Is that a correct thing to say?
I think that's the way that we understand most bacteria these days, or at least most cheesemakers understand bacteria, as these are our friendly bacteria that perform a role and are functionally useful to us. And then there are another category of bad bacteria, which are potential pathogens and could make people sick if they end up in the wrong place or grow to high levels. And in a way, that sort of mentality. There's a really interesting anthropologist operating in the U.S. called Heather Paxton, and she talks about what she calls a Pasteurian mindset, which is really epitomized in this idea of classifying bacteria as good or bad, and really aiming to get rid of all the bad ones and just put the good ones where you want them when you want them. And I think the more that we've learned about the way cheese and farming actually work, the more our mentality is shifting towards that of ecologies and understanding that maybe nothing is necessarily good or bad, or good and bad is a social construction. Obviously, pathogenic bacteria can make us sick and we really don't want to have them in our cheese. But rather than this idea of writing off anything that can be a pathogen as an unfriendly bacteria that we don't want, I think understanding more about the idea of things being out of balance being the fundamental problem.
That's interesting. So it's a more complex, so in a sort of sense, it's like an ecosystem then of bacteria, and we need to sort of deepen, make our understanding more complex of it then? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, absolutely. And I think I'll just qualify what I said right there, because I don't want people to take away from this that Bronwyn says that it's fine to have pathogens in your cheese, because that's not what I'm saying at all. But if you look at the annals of scientific literature, particularly in medical reports, you can see that there are many examples of people getting sick from infections of lactic acid bacteria, the very same bacteria that we want to encourage to grow to incredibly high levels in the cheese. And in fact, the same thing is true of ripening bacteria. The same bacteria that can grow on the outside of a cheese and create delicious flavors are also associated with infections if they're in the wrong place, out of balance with the other microbes that are there, and perhaps in immunocompromised individuals. And that doesn't mean that eating those cheeses presents a risk that somebody will get infected with them, but only to say that bacteria's a bacterium's utility to us is definitely unlinked from any idea about whether or not that same exact organism could make somebody sick in a different circumstance.
That's interesting. Okay. And perhaps we could unpick it slightly, because you mentioned the lactic acid bacterium. Perhaps you could talk us through, Bronwyn, because I think people, this idea that microbes play a part in cheesemaking, for someone who's not a cheesemaker, it can be very abstract. Could you sort of talk us through a concrete example of what, you choose, what something is doing within cheesemaking? Take us into that world, this very complex world of bacteria.
Of course. I mean, I think it makes sense to start with the lactic acid bacteria, because these are omnipresent in almost every kind of cheese that we have. Lactic acid bacteria will play a part. And really, cheese making is a process of preserving milk. That's the whole reason we're doing it, and it's preserved for two reasons. The first reason is that we're taking loads of moisture out of that milk, so we're making it much drier And that is a preservative factor. And the other thing that's happening is that we're fermenting it. And that fermentation is a microbial process. It's a bacterial process specifically. And the role that the lactic acid bacteria play is that they take these very digestible sugars in milk and they transform them into lactic acid, which is a molecule that is, as you can imagine, acidic. And that actually then that high acidity level will discourage other spoilage microorganisms from taking hold there or from growing. So at once it's digesting, it's taking away something that is very, very prone to spoilage, the lactose, and then it's turning it into something, the lactic acid, that's a preservative at the same time. And in the process, it's getting some food for itself, it's making energy, and it's growing to very, very high levels within the cheese. And so that process of bacterial fermentation is really fundamental to cheese production pretty much across the board.
That is pretty brilliant then, isn't it? I mean, from a human point of view, that the lactic acid bacteria are not only they're creating an environment that is discouraging
spoilage.
Yeah, isn't that brilliant? Wow.
It is, and it's not limited to cheese. I mean, those same lactic acid bacteria are also performing pretty much the same role in pickles like kimchi, in sausages, fermented salamis. This phenomenon is not in any way limited to milk.
Yeah, no. I mean, fermentation, which is now ever so fashionable in a way, but yet, of course, has been such a long part of our human diet and played such an intrinsic role. But I think, again, just we hadn't realised quite how important it was. Sandor Katz is such a fascinating man. If anyone's interested in reading more about fermentation, do read his books. So, yes, and so thank you, Bronwyn. That's very lucid and interesting. Could you also then talk about yeast and molds, which you mentioned as playing a part in later stages, and again give us examples of how that would work in cheese making?
So in the same way that interesting milk is primed with its own population of lactic acid bacteria, it also contains very low populations generally of other microorganisms that are not bacteria. And these are our fungal populations, which include yeasts and molds. And because these are aerobic organisms, meaning that they need air to grow, they're really not operating in the milk vat as the cheese is being made. If you can imagine, inside a vat of milk is a pretty low oxygen environment, and these lactic acid bacteria really don't like oxygen that much. So that's an anaerobic process, a process that happens without oxygen. But then as the cheese is made and is maturing, these more aerobic microorganisms, the yeast and the molds, and to a certain extent aerobic bacteria, but we're focusing on yeast and molds right now, start growing on the outside of the cheese and forming a rind. And that's what, we can see very clearly with our eyes, the microbial mats that are formed by these yeasts and molds as cheese rinds, because when you get billions of microbes in one place, you do start to be able to see them.
Isn't that interesting? So that's, and it's one of the things, often talk when I'm talking to cheesemakers is, what they're doing in order to try and encourage what they want. Let's say geotrichum is something that often comes up as something that cheesemakers want. So you could talk us through that. And I get the impression when I talk that some microbes are easier to cultivate in a way than others. I don't know if that's true or not.
I think it probably is. So geo, and depending on what continent you're listening from, you could hear it as geotrichum or geotrichum. We tend to call it geotrichum over here. Is an interesting microbe and very fashionable in the world of soft cheese these days. It is an organism that has mold-like features and yeast-like features, but you can really recognize it on the outside of soft cheeses and lactic goat cheeses. It's the one that looks a bit brainy and sort of cream colored, like a very soft moleskin. It's a lovely, you ask many cheesemakers what their favorite yeast or mold is, and they all will say that it's Geo. It's really the darling of the cheese world.
For me, it signals a delicious cheese I'm going to enjoy eating.
And it's very interesting because it is great on its own, and it can form those really beautiful goat cheese rinds, for example, or the rind of a cow's milk cheese like St. Jude is a geo rind. But it also plays a really important role in concert with another very important cheese ripening mold, Penicillium, on the coat of things like Brie. So with sort of I want to say old-fashioned cheese making, but it's probably a bad term because by old-fashioned I'm referring to sort of the cheese making of the 1970s and 1980s, where you were looking for these really flat white Penicillium rinds that were fairly uninteresting but looked sort of quite bland and like driven snow. And you can still find them on the surface of many cheeses, and I suppose some people do like them, but they can tend to be quite papery and cardboardy. Nowadays, people who are making those soft ripened cheeses that are of the sort of Brie and Camembert style will often inoculate their cheese with both Geotrichum and Penicillium, and they'll use what's called microbial succession, sort of the way in which one species paves the way and alters the environment for the next one to grow. Geo is very good at growing on the surface of very fresh cheeses within the first couple of days, and it paves the way for a much more thin and, dare I say, elegant kind of coating of Penicillium. So if you look at the rind of something like the Tunworth or the Baron Bygod, that's a rind that, you know, we think about it as a mold ripened, you know, a white mold ripened cheese, both of those. But actually, if you look closely, there's a base coat of this yeast. And then on top of it, once it's paved the way, the Penicillium grows. But it gives you that lovely wrinkly appearance. And it also gives you a lot more complexity of flavor. A lot of the more cabbagey, sort of mushroomy notes that we associate with that, the most interesting varieties of those styles of cheese.
Wonderful. Isn't that interesting? Yeah, I mean, that's so, so fascinating. And so, one of the things we've talked about, in fact, to you, Bronwyn, is about raw milk as opposed to pasteurised milk. And so is there a feeling in the cheesemaking world that if you're making raw milk, which has presumably a larger community of microbes because it's not been treated in order to get rid of some of them, is this a potentially very interesting way to go to explore the sort of, to harness the microbial richness when it comes to making cheese? Well,
certainly. And you know, it's very interesting because it's not as simple as saying, oh, if you pasteurize then you get rid of all the microbes in the milk. As we were talking about before, certain microbes from all of the different categories, yeast, molds, bacteria, are thermoduric and they will survive pasteurization, and other ones will be killed. So you're changing the microbial balance of the milk whenever you do a heat treatment of any kind in whatever way. And then really it's so if you want the best, you know, the most complete expression of a milk that you farmed expressly for cheesemaking, obviously raw milk is going to give that to you in a way that if you're heat treating you won't necessarily have. That said, I would say another really important factor is what sort of an environment you're creating for those microbes to grow. Because the amazing thing about microbes is that when you give them the right conditions, they'll go through a process of exponential growth that will mean that you end up with, you know, one cell, one organism can turn into millions or billions of organisms in a relatively short time. And as a result of that, all you need is a very small initial number and the right conditions to create something that's very pervasive within the cheese. And controlling those environments, both in terms of how you manage the make, but also the maturation, can have a huge impact on the microbial communities that ultimately develop.
That's interesting. So, and one of the things, again, I've talked about on this series is sort of cheese maturing and care and attention and creating. So is it that thing where the cheesemaker knows that if you want, let's say, I don't know, if you're making a washed rind cheese and you want a particular result, that you put it in an environment that will help that result come? There's a whole set of conditions, of environmental conditions that the cheesemaker or whoever's doing the maturing will use then?
Absolutely. And by conditions, I mean not only sort of what's the temperature and humidity of the room that you're putting into, but how are you actually treating the surface of the cheese? Are you washing it with water? Which, of course, is going to have a really big impact on sort of aerobic molds that need air, and maybe encourage some different ones that don't mind being washed every day or every other day. So yes, absolutely. The conditions and then the treatment of the cheese will really is the cheesemaker's opportunity to sort of influence the evolution of those microbial communities and sort of zero in on the combinations that they want in order to produce the best and most interesting appearance and flavour.
And, you know, Bronwyn, do you see in British cheesemakers a desire to explore this sort of, you know, in a way, the complexity you've talked about the microbial world? Is this something that you're seeing cheesemakers? They, you know, when I talk to cheesemakers, you get the sense there's so many different factors that they're working with. But is this something that they find exciting and interesting, you know, to explore? Are they taking steps to try and sort of work with it?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what we can see is really more than ever, people wanting to increase the sophistication and the complexity of the communities that are growing within and on their cheeses and use that as a route to making cheeses that are unique. There's also, I think, more tools available to us than ever before in terms of things that you can add to your milk or spray onto your cheese that will give you very particular effects. So, for example, there's a company in Normandy that is a culture house and is working with the University in Normandy to sort of catalog and propagate its collection of 200 different strains of Geo, or more than that. Each of which are listed according to their characteristics. So there's some that are whiter and some that are more furry and some that they describe as having a sort of hedgehog-like texture with little, you know, little sort of spikes sticking up and so on and so forth. And that really for cheesemakers now you have almost the capacity to dial in exactly what kind of flavors and aromas and appearances that you want by being quite sophisticated about what you're adding. I think that's extremely exciting from a sort of practical perspective. And then the other thing that people, in my opinion, need to be thinking about is the difference between harnessing the commercial cultures, which are theoretically available to anyone who buys cultures from that same culture house, and really being able to propagate the ones that are in your milk and truly an expression of your farm. And I think there will be routes for interesting cheeses to be made using all sorts of techniques.
It's exciting, isn't it? And then, you know, and of course, one of the joys of, you know, in that latter point you were making about using the microbes as an expression of where you are. And then, of course, this means that, you know, that and we're, you know, cheesemakers in America, cheesemakers in around the world have got the chance in a way to make something that is very unique then to them.
Absolutely. And ultimately, you know, provided their milk has something interesting to say, and that they can harness it correctly, you have capacity for really incredible and extraordinary diversity. One of the interesting things that came out of a study that was done in France a few years ago, again in Normandy, where they've done a lot of work on lactic acid and ripening bacteria, is a catalog of different, you know, different strains of lactic acid bacteria. They just went to a few different farms and cultured what was in the milk and found new strains of Lactococcus lactis, which is the key, you know, lactic acid bacterium for making Camembert style cheese. And many of those strains had no, you know, had very little relation to the strains that were in the library. And they were finding that actually the diversity that was out in the world was so much greater, even in a well-known organism like Lactococcus lactis, than they had even fathomed. And so I do think that there is an enormous potential to discover diversity that we don't even know exists yet and to put it to work for us making delicious cheese.
Wonderful. Well, that's a very exciting thought. Brilliant, Bronwyn, thank you so much for sharing, you know, your insights and knowledge with us. It's really much appreciated. Thank you, Bronwyn.
It's been a pleasure.
I'm a huge fan of Peter's Yard's crackers, and they go beautifully with cheese. All Peter's Yard's crackers are made in small batches using quality natural ingredients and their sourdough starter, slowly fermented for 16 hours for award-winning flavour and crunch. Visit petersyard.com/shop, enter the code SLICEOFCHEESE at the checkout to receive 25% off your first order.
Online, on smart speakers and on Listen Again, this is Food FM.
Savour the crunch of Peter's Yard sourdough crackers. Available at Waitrose, Sainsbury's, Morrison's, Ocado, Amazon, petersyard.com and specialist food retailers.
So this week on A Slice of Cheese, we're looking at the sort of fascinating world of microbes. I'm very happy to have with me all the way from New York, Josh Windsor, Afiner. Hello, Josh.
Hi, Jenny. Thanks for having me on.
Josh, I did think of you because I follow you on Instagram and your feed is sort of fascinating with these beautiful photographs of moulds growing on cheeses and your very eloquent descriptions. So I thought it'd be lovely to talk to you about it. I mean, perhaps we should start by explaining to people, you know, what an affiner does and why you've got this very special insight into that sort of world of microbial activity in cheese.
Certainly. So an affineur is anyone who ages cheese. So I think technically the term means to complete or finish a cheese from its Latin roots. But it's the person who takes cheese once it comes out of the mold and sees it through the journey until it's ready to be eaten, whether, you know, over a couple of days to a couple of years. And then, you know, affineurs can be, you know, independent of cheese makers. Like in the production of Comté, they can be part of the creamery production cycle, as most are. Or in the case for myself, I work with Murray's Cheese in New York City, so we are a cheese retailer, but we also do our own affinage on a select handful of cheeses that they produce.
That's good. Thank you. That's very clear. And so I was thinking, Josh, you know, and you mentioned that, in fact, you know, cheeses can take days or weeks or months or years to, you know, to reach the point at which you'd want to sell them. So you've got this incredibly sort of close, contact, haven't you, with the cheeses, because it is a lot of care. And perhaps give us an insight into some of the things that you would be doing as an affineur.
Certainly. We work with a wide variety of cheeses. This morning, I spent my entire morning washing wash-drying cheeses, aptly named. For example, with that particular cheese, you're taking a green cheese, a fresh, unaged cheese, and you're washing it in a saltwater solution. Mm-hmm. And this is done in order to selectively develop the rind. You're basically creating an environment for specific microbes to form on the outside of that and set the path and direction of that cheese ripening. Other activities are so in our caves, I think is the easiest way to describe it. We have four unique caves and environments in which we age cheese, and each is dedicated to a specific style of affinage. So our washed rind cheeses are done in our wash rind cave. We have a bloomy cave for our soft ripened bloomy cheeses, and this is where we're developing cheese rinds that are almost monocultures. They're single species of mold or yeast on the outside of it. So these are like your camemberts and bries or your ashed goat cheeses. We have a natural cave, which is a natural rind, which is probably the most diverse genetically in terms of rind formation, where it's, I often describe this as non-interventionist affinage. You're doing as little as you can to influence the rind, and just allowing whatever is in the environment and what comes in on the milk and from the creamery to grow on the outside of the cheese. And then we have an alpine cave where we're really relying on the microbes that are interior to the cheese that were originally used to acidify the milk to develop and age that cheese. And the rind is more just a casing and less of a microbial population.
Right, that's so interesting, isn't it? I mean, it is that, and perhaps we should also explain that a lot of cheesemakers, when they make cheese, they put in microbes, and they use these what are called starter cultures, aren't they? Perhaps you could tell us what starter cultures are broadly. I realise that they're varied, but just give us a broad stroke picture of what a starter culture might be for a cheesemaker.
Yeah, the majority of starter cultures are what we call lactic acid bacteria, or LAB. And so these are bacteria that feed on lactose, the sugar that is in milk. They're able to metabolize it to break it down. And part of the process of that creates lactic acid. So in beer making and brewing, we use a yeast called Saccharomyces cerevisiae to consume the sugars, the malt that is in the wort, and turn it into alcohol and carbon dioxide. In cheese making, we turn lactose into lactic acid.
Because you talked about having, you know, the with your alpine cheeses, that the sort of, you know, the activity is internal, isn't it? It's not on the rind. So you have, that's another really interesting difference between cheeses, and that some of them, for some, the activity is very much taking place on the rind. Am I supposed for you, is that so for you as an affineur, are these the cheeses that are particularly interesting? Are these the ones that you watch over, you know, very closely?
Yeah, so So all cheese ripens from the inside, right? So the lactic acid bacteria that was there from the start eventually starts to die off, and those cells break open, and the enzymes that are in there contribute to the flavor and textural development of the cheese. But if you leave that rind exposed to air, then you get microbes from the environment that also populate the outside of that cheese, and those can ripen from the outside in. And so for like on your bloomy style cheeses, those are the ones that develop that beautiful cream line, that spot between the rind and the paste that starts to ooze and, you know, often tastes like intensely of mushroom. Mm-hmm. On that, all of that is from the microbial population that's growing on the outside of it. That mold, Penicillium camemberti, really loves the protein. It feeds off the protein in the cheese and starts breaking it down, and that's what actually forms that cream line. And that process of breaking down the proteins also creates a vast array of aromatic chemicals that become the flavor of the cheese that you just can't get without a rind formation on it.
Right. I mean, yes, I think, you know, it's so interesting, isn't it? How does cheese get its flavor? And obviously microbes are so essential to it, aren't they? I mean, you must be very aware of that, Josh. Perhaps talk us through a cheese, you know, coming in, let's say, you know, a very young cheese. You pick whatever one you want, and take us through with you on what you would be seeing and feeling and smelling as an affiner in terms of its sort of microbial activity on the cheese, and things you'd look out for and the things you would be worried about.
Certainly. Let's see. A good example of that would be the Ash goat cheeses. These are cheeses that are modeled after the classic Loire Valley cheeses like Valencay and Salsechère. So these cheeses come in green, and these cheeses are highly acidic when they first come in. So if you were to taste one of them, they would taste pretty much like fresh chèvre. They would be a little salty, but not a lot of aromatic complexity on them. Mm. Maybe a little bit of milkiness, but really just bright, tangy acid and salt. And these cheeses age with a very particular yeast called Geotrichum candidum. And it's easily recognizable in the end product because it looks like this like brainy, labyrinthine pattern all around the cheese. That's the yeast Geotrichum. And Geotrichum does not like an acidic environment. And so since we're starting with a very high acid cheese, we need to do something to reduce the acidity on the outside of it. And we do that by adding charcoal or vegetable ash to the outside. Mm. It's an alkaline product. And so that deacidifies the outside of the cheese. And then that cheese will go into a drying room. And the hope is from an affinage perspective is that by putting it in an environment that is warm and a little humid, but not as humid as the aging cave on it, that we give the Geotrichum a head start above all the other molds and bacteria that could be in the environment, that we create the perfect condition by deacidifying the rind, managing the temperature and humidity, that Geotrichum starts to form on it. And that happens usually between 24 to 40 hours, you'll start to see a small amount of this yeast forming on the outside of it. And it's like a soft, pillowy blanket. It hasn't formed those deep ridges in the final cheese, but it will start to dull in color. And this is often called the jolie robe, the petite, beautiful dress that the cheese will wear.
How lovely. What a lovely expression. Yes.
Right. Yeah, the French have delightful phrases for the rinds of cheeses.
Yes, that's sort of perfect, isn't it? As they should. Yes, so, yeah, good. Yeah, brilliant. So then what happens with that? This little patch, does it start to grow? Is it fighting off other? Is it in competition with others? Is that one of the issues?
Yeah, the entire development, it will be in competition with others. In these early stages is when it's most vulnerable. And so it gets the most attention. So it's going to start feeding on this nutrient-rich cheese that we gave it to feast upon. And it will start breaking down the fats and proteins that are in the cheese. And it will start to develop the cream line. And if you keep a high temperature in a moist environment, which the yeast really likes, it will feast very, very quickly. And that cream line can develop and turn the cheese into soup overnight. It's too much. Yeah. So then we're using temperature and humidity to slow the process down. So we'll start to cool the cheese off, and we will start drying out the room more and more, so that as the cream line forms, we're evaporating more liquid, so it doesn't just become soupy. We're also flipping that cheese, because the proteins are breaking down, calcium is getting released into the cheese. That's going to drop to the bottom of the cheese, so the cheese needs to be flipped over so the calcium evenly distributes. Oh. In cheese making, we often refer to calcium as the glue that holds everything together. So calcium is very important in the structure of cheese. And once the rind is completely formed, and we're pretty sure that the geo has won out and it is going to be the big ripener of the cheese, we move it out of the drying room and into the cave environment, which is a very cold or cool temperature, high humidity, which then allows the cheese to ripen over the last week or so of its age. And it's more of a slow process. So it's not really overly developing the cream line, but just allowing the aromatic qualities of the cheese to develop during that time.
And so by the end, how many weeks would you have invested in looking after this cheese by the time when you think it's ready then?
For these style cheeses, they're in our caves 2 weeks. So from the time that we ash them to the time that we wrap them and release them.
And what would you consider a good example? What would you be looking for? Until you talked about, you know, flavor and aroma, what are the things that you'd be looking for in a well-ripened, you know, example of an ash cheese?
Yeah, certainly. So over that time, there's going to be a big textural change. Instead of being kind of creamy and a little crumbly, like breaking off and big pieces, the paste will have condensed a bit, so it's going to taste a little saltier and it's going to be smoother throughout the body of the cheese. The cream line will have developed a little bit, so you'll have that oozing portion. The acidity will have dropped significantly, because that lactic acid is part of what's combining with the broken proteins to create the aromas. So it's going to be much milder and less bright and tangy. And then with those particular cheeses, they have a whole world of earthy aromas. often, you know, where you get button mushroom on your camemberts, these are more like foraged oyster mushrooms, just more robust in their
mushrooms. Flavor profile. Yes. Yeah. Wow. So it's such sort of close work, isn't it, Josh? I mean, and then some cheeses. So is it sort of source of fascination for you to watch these microbes? But I did wonder, are there unwanted molds or microbes that you just really like, oh no, as an affiner, would your heart just sink? You think, oh my goodness, I did not want to see this, you know, in one of my rooms.
And that cheese, anything other than the geo that grows on it. So the mucor is a mold that on bloomies can form. Mucor is everywhere in the world. It is a mold in the ecosystem, its primary role is to break down plant matter. So it's like you'll see it a lot in the fall when leaves are falling from the trees. It's a good biodegrader. But it shows up in cheese. It's actually the same mold that is used to age Saint Nectaire. So some cheeses you want it, but on bloomy cheeses, it's when people see it for the first time, they're a little shocked by it. The nickname for this mold in the cheese world is cat hair mold, and it looks much like the fur of a cat, which can be kind of frightening in a bloomy style cheese.
Yes.
And it can overproduce some very pungent, earthy aromas in the cheese when it forms. A small amount is not going to do too much flavorly. It's just going to look a little off. But in large amounts, it can definitely change the texture and the flavor.
I mean, do you think that, you know, humans are, you know, that word mold or bacteria, you know, they've got a very sort of negative associations with them, I think. You know, people don't, you know, it's partly why I wanted to do this program, actually, was to sort of explain that, you know, they're good bacteria and bad bacteria, and in fact, well, you know, surrounded by bacteria, and they're doing so much all the time that we often don't understand, or because we don't see, you know, particularly what's happening. So is that part one of your roles, do you think, that do you find yourself explaining? I don't know if you tell friends that you're an affineur, and then do you start sort of enthusing about molds and trying to get them to see them in a new way?
100%. It's part of the reason why I talk about mold so much and get excited about it. One of the really interesting things about a lot of the foods that we eat, but cheese being one of them, is that they're fermented. They're controlled spoilage. We extend the shelf life of these foods by having some control over their spoilage, so they're not rapidly spoiling, but we're intervening to allow that spoilage to happen over time. And this is, bread is controlled spoilage, beer is controlled spoilage, and cheese is. And microbes that often we would think of as being spoilage microbes play a role in that. And so it's a fine line between what is a delicacy and what is spoiled. And a lot of that is culturally determined, for us as humans. And so everyone has a different relationship to fermented foods and mold growing on foods. So I like to just be upfront about it as much as I can to get people to understand that it's just a perspective and not necessarily something to be feared.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, in fact, I was struck by the way, when you talk about the bacteria and the mold, Josh, you sound affectionate. You sound like you sound really fond of what's growing on the cheeses. And am I imagining this, or is this true?
No, I have a huge, I love growing the cheeses. Working as an affineur, you don't get to see the inside of the cheese most of the time. So you're spending all of this time tending and caring for and ushering a cheese towards its, final delicious product. And the only indication you have is the rind, is these microbes that grow on the outside. So we don't know a lot about most of the microbes that grow on the outside of cheeses. So a lot of the time is just speculating and wondering what is an indication of it going the right way and what is an indication of it going the wrong way. A lot of trial and error. And so, they are something that, like, a farmer has fondness for the crops that they grow. It's a very, very similar relationship.
I mean, again, isn't that interesting? Because so much of, and as you know, Josh, I'm talking to cheesemakers and cheesemongers and people who work with cheese and affineurs, what always comes across actually is the complexity of making cheese, that there is actually so much we don't understand, despite the thousands of years humans have been making cheese, which I think is part of its allures of cheese, that it's not as simple, it's straightforward. It's an intriguing, fascinating, changing food, isn't it? Which absolutely is a sort of living with this microbial activity. This is life, isn't it, that you're working with?
Yeah, exactly. And it's equal parts science, craft, and mystery.
Which, yeah, lovely. Well, you sound very content. Brilliant, Josh. Listen, thank you so much for taking time out of all your careful cheese tending to tell us about the wonderful world of microbes. It's much appreciated. Thank you, Josh.
Oh, thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.
Thank you so much for listening to A Slice of Cheese. I hope you've enjoyed it. If you have enjoyed it, it would be lovely if you could rate us on wherever you've found this podcast. It will make such a difference to us. So I hope you'll enjoy us again. Thank you very much.